Well, you've seen them make watches out of aircraft. Now, here's a watch made out of a car, specifically a Porsche 956. If you grew up in the 80s and 90s like I did, you'll be very familiar with the shape of this car, even if you didn't actually know what racing was at that point. Very few were ever built because it was specifically a long-distance racing car, not designed for regular road use. While these cars dominated early 1980s endurance racing, one particular vehicle, Chassis 106, had been modified by its owners using a new aluminium honeycomb tub. This, along with a few other modifications, led to Porsche redesignating it Chassis 106B, and it proved itself swifter than factory stock models of the 956. And as a result, it scored multiple podium finishes. It also had something of a charmed life. Living on the edge, as 956s tended to do, a number were involved in various crashes. 106B wouldn't be immune to this, but thanks in part to the new aluminium honeycomb construction, the driver lived and the vehicle was rebuilt, going on to win the famous Brands Hatch 1,000-kilometre race. In the later 80s, the 956 was retired on safety grounds from endurance racing, but 106B managed to survive retirement, and REC Watches have acquired one of its aluminium clutch discs. Incorporating this into their 956-106B limited run of 956 watches. This collection is currently available for pre-order, and if you visit the link in the description below, and then if you want to pre-order one and use the code DRAC, you'll get an additional discount off the pre-order discount. There are two different colour choices, and other elements of the design have also been inspired by the 956 and motorsport racing in general. So thanks very much to REC for sponsoring this video, and now, on with the main show. Hello everyone! A few people have asked me what I thought of the Battleship of the Future, by Popular Mechanics at circa September 1940. So, today we're going to take a brief look at the few strengths and many, many, many weaknesses of this particular design. Now, the funny thing is, you've probably most all seen this picture and possibly even this spread and imagine that maybe there was more to it, but genuinely there isn't. The next page on the issue of Popular Mechanics in question is about kite flying, of all things. So this is all the information we've got to go on, and it also means this is all the pictures we've got to go off of. So I do apologize, but you'll be seeing some rather repetitive picture use during this video, although there are a couple of additional drawings courtesy of the wonderful Tsoli, who's actually done a side and top view in his style of this vessel. So we're going to be looking at the big ship in the middle rather than the small one off to the left, and you'll see why in a second. So to establish the particulars of what we're looking at, we will look at some of the detailed caption sections, but first I'm just going to read you the, well, couple of paragraphs that compose the entirety of the article first, so you got some idea of what this thing is and why it was designed, such as it is a design. Anyway, it says, radical changes in the dreadnought design are coming out of the war tests between battleship and bomber. Obviously, this is being written in late 1940, so the war's been going on for about a year at this point. Chief among them, the streamlining of decks and turrets, not for aerodynamic reasons, but to fend off aerial bombs and the multiplication of anti-aircraft batteries. Well, I'll agree with you. In the first year of the war, the need for more anti-aircraft batteries was very definitely made clear, but given this thing looks a bit like the seaborne equivalent of a Coronation-class locomotive, I'm not necessarily going to believe the, oh, honestly, it's not for aerodynamic reasons section. Anyway, Otto Kuhler, American designer, suggests the whaleback battleship at the bottom of this page. Its foredeck is roofed with heavy armor plate, quantities of anti-aircraft guns over the enclosed bridge, and streamlined aft turret, below which is a hangar housing bombers, fighters, and reconnaissance planes launched by catapult. The larger drawing is of an English designer showing a similar arched superstructure designed to let bombs and shells ricochet off with minimum damage. This battleship would have exhaust outlets at the stern, displacing the conventional funnel, and its 70,000 tons would call for turbines of 252,000 horsepower driving six propellers. Armament includes 18 14-inch guns, 24 5.25-inch guns, 16 4.7-inch anti-aircraft guns, and seven multiple pom-poms. So to start off with, using this slightly higher resolution scan, we're going to go from bow to stern, looking at the various features that are labelled in the diagram, discuss whether that's a good or a bad idea, and some of the associated features in that area of the ship as well, before we head off and look at the two cross sections and see about those details and how they may or may not work in practice. So over here down at the bow, we have a wave register. That's just a thing. Doesn't really affect ship design much either way. But then we have a whaleback forecastle and internal capstan gear. The internal capstan gear, you can take it or leave it. You know, there's a fair bit of this going on in earlier ironclads. It doesn't really actually make all that much odds. There's some advantages to having the chain outside, especially in terms of cleaning the stuff. But if you're willing to put up with having to clean the chains inside the forecastle and then sluice out all the horrible, disgusting muck by some sort of drainage system, then that's fine. The whaleback forecastle, however, is an immediate problem. Now, you'll notice the ship does have a raked bow and a flared sides of the bow as well, so seakeeping's not completely awful, but whaleback forecastles are relatively low in terms of freeboard, and compared to their peak, which is of course going to be down the center line, they have lower edges. Now, yes, a whaleback does allow you to shed water somewhat more easily than a flat deck, but because of that lower deck edge, it also means you get water on board somewhat more easily. And as the various whaleback freighters that were tried around this time and slightly earlier showed, the theory of it'll move through the water easier doesn't really play out in practice, because the slight reduction in energy loss caused by shedding the water really nice and easily is far more than countered by the fact you're taking water over the bow a lot more often. So that's our first big weakness. I'd also like to note at this point that the design of the breakwater is also not all that brilliant, because it slopes up in a nice curved fashion. Now, it does appear, thanks to that shadow, to act then double back on itself, which should act as a form of deflection for at least a little bit of water. But the fact it's curving up nice and gently and basically giving a nice acceleration ramp to water in the muck, for the most part, means that if you do take a significant sea over the bow, and with a whaleback forecastle you're very likely to, then it's very likely that the water coming up here is actually going to be deeper than the height of that overhang, and thus all you're doing is, you know, launching massive jets of water over your forward main armament, which isn't a brilliant idea. And speaking of the main armament, let's move over to here. There. Now, we have, starting from the left, concealed boats. Take it or leave it, really. I mean, yes, having a concealed boat would make the boats somewhat less susceptible to shrapnel damage, assuming that the doors and the superstructure plating is at least shrapnel proof, so you need at least a half an inch to an inch of steel. But it does actually have quite a number of complications. For one thing, I can't see any davits for the lowering of the boats, and I also can't see any cranes in the vicinity for the lowering of the boats either. No king post or anything. So quite how they're intending to get the boats over the side, unless they just wait for the ship to sink low enough for the main deck to be awash, I'm not entirely sure. The other problem is that unless you do put, I would say, probably at least an inch or more of plating over the boats, it's only going to protect you from bullets and general long-distance shrapnel. A shell hit that lands where the boats might otherwise be, or along the edge of the ship, that's still going to go through in most superstructure plating cases. So you've just, you know, put a fire hazard inside the superstructure and made it less accessible, as opposed to having the boats outside or just not having them. So I'm not entirely sure if that's a good idea on balance, but to be perfectly honest, it probably is the least of the problems in this picture. So you have a streamlined superstructure that in and of itself isn't necessarily a problem, because, well, streamlining of superstructures to reduce air resistance was actually historically done, Fuso aside. But in this particular case, this, you know, it's not just rounded forward, which is, as I say, very clearly for aerodynamics. It's also rounded on top in this kind of half cylinder. That's actually going to significantly reduce your internal superstructure volume. And since that is where you store quite a lot of useful things, including officers, you may actually have problems with this vessel and accommodating everybody, albeit that without the funnel trunking, you may be saving space in the overall superstructure, which we'll see in a minute. Now, then we get to the main armament. Right, all gun turrets, etc., rounded off to avoid direct hits and extra protection for the barbettes. So, extra protection for the barbettes, no, this is actually a very bad idea. For one thing, there's no indication that this is actual armor plate. If it is, you're actually adding quite a bit of weight and you're going to affect this ship's stability. So if this really is armor plate and the ship is not hilariously unstable, then it's very thin armor plate, at which point it's not actually adding all that much protection to the barbettes, because the barbettes themselves are some of the thickest armor plates on the ship, usually. But the big downside, and the reason why I say this is a bad idea in general, is, well, look at how the superstructure and this supposed extra protection is flush up against the turrets. Now, if we assume for a moment that the turret rotation can actually move, obviously this being an artist's depiction, we can provide a little bit of leeway. The problem is any amount of battle damage to this extra protection or further back superstructure plating that causes any form of deformation, which, you know, a large bomb or a shell hit would do, that's going to jam at least one, possibly more turrets immediately, because you're going to be jabbing big sheets of metal right into the path of the turret. There is a reason why turrets didn't really do this in real life. Now, as for the gun turrets rounded off to avoid direct hits, this isn't a terrible idea per se. Having a continuously rounded surface does make a directly perpendicular hit less likely. And indeed, you do see historically some turrets are far more curved than others. However, for the overall floor space of the turret, a very heavily curved turret like this is actually going to have significantly reduced internal volume, which means either it's going to be very cramped, or you're going to have to make the turret overall considerably larger than you would if it was a little bit more squared off, which is going to add weight. So you're trading off either the thing is cramped or it's a bit too heavy compared to its contemporaries for a relatively minimal benefit, because while there is a very small margin right at the edge where the curve gets quite steep, where maybe a bomb might be deflected by the curvature of the turret rather than hitting it and exploding, that's a very, very narrow window. Across most of the turret roof, or what would otherwise be the turret roof, the curve isn't sharp enough to actually significantly deflect any incoming munition much more than it would be normally. And of course, compared to a flat roof, a shell that hits where the turret is sloping down towards it is actually, of course, therefore hitting at a somewhat steeper angle, i.e. closer to normal, than it would against a flat roof. The curve only really helps there if either the shell comes in and lands on a reverse slope, or if it impacts near the turret face in a very narrow margin where the curve, again, is slightly away, whereas otherwise it would be more flat. So there are a few very small regions on these turrets which might assist with either deflecting or more likely just providing greater apparent thickness to an incoming shell or bomb. But the trade-off of in other areas actually being more vulnerable, plus either additional weight or cramped conditions, means that this isn't the best design decision. And then you have the fact that you have no less than three turrets here, triple stack super firing. Now, granted, Admiral Fisher did look into this for one of the preliminary designs for HMS Dreadnought, but one, he was using twin 12-inch turrets, not 14-inch guns. And two, he ended up not going for that idea for very big stability-related reasons, this seems to be a bit of a running theme with this vessel. Incidentally, the quad super-firing octuple pom-pom up there, that's actually not too bad at all. That's got a fairly nice field of fire. although actually getting to that installation would be rather interesting. Nonetheless, another problem you've got with this triple stack arrangement is the fact that you have three different turrets. There's a quad at the bottom, a triple in the middle, and a twin at the top. Now, you might be saying, oh, hang on, but doesn't that help ameliorate the stability issue somewhat because each turret is going to be progressively lighter? Technically speaking, yes, that is the case. However, they're still 14-inch gun turrets, which means there's still going to be a fair weight implication and thus a stability implication. And, of course, the barbette of the super firing turret, the twin, is going to add its own weight as well. And then you also have manufacturing considerations. Now, manufacturing a continuously curved turret like this is going to be much more demanding than a more standard turret anyway, but you also now don't have commonality. You're going to have to produce each one of these turrets as a separate design. And now, granted, there is another twin, another triple, and another quad further aft, but that basically means for the 18 guns you're fitting on this ship, you need three different kinds of turret, all of which are going to need their own designs, all of which are going to have different weight implications, different power requirements, different manufacturing requirements, etc. So this is going to be hideously complicated and very, very expensive. Now, in comparison, if you deleted the twin turret entirely and replaced the triple with a quad, you'd have just one kind of turret that you'd need to make, and you'd have only lost one gun's worth of firepower. You'd have eight guns instead of nine, and you've saved an entire twin turrets and barbettes worth of weight from a rather high position in the ship. And given that you've got a triple super firing over a quad aft, if you replace that triple with a quad as well, you actually have no net change in firepower, but you save a whole lot of weight, assuming that you leave the amidships twin in place. And oh boy, will we come to that in a second. But yeah, this is possibly one of the least efficient ways of getting a nine-gun forward salvo. I do have the secondary breakwater. It looks like the designer possibly realised that first breakwater wasn't going to work very well in heavy seas. So, moving a little bit further aft again. It says no smoke interference with control positions. Well, that's good, I suppose. You'll notice there's another pom-pom installation aft at the top of the superstructure, a twin pom-pom, and then we're down to the heavy AA batteries. Now, we also have fuel valve boilers. Either odds, it's just a type of boiler. Now, each engine and boiler room in separate watertight compartments, aka the unit system, that's actually a pretty decent idea. You know, most battleship designers in this time period are trying to implement this if they can find the tonnage to do so. So, plus points for that. Dual-purpose exhaust and bilge, however, no, this is an awful idea, but we'll cover that in more detail when we get to the cross section at the left hand side of the page. The only other label in this section is heavy anti-aircraft armament and clear arcs of fire. Now, heavy anti-aircraft armament, I can agree with that. Clear arcs of fire, how exactly are you saying this? Let's take a look at this. I mean, you kind of get the same nest replicated slightly further aft, so this applies to both. We have what are presumably the 5.25-inch turrets clustered in this little three-turret position, and then immediately above them and on either side are 4.7-inch turrets. Now, while it might seem at times that the Royal Navy at this time period was obsessed with having every decimal point between 4 and 5.5 filled with some kind of gun, having 5.25 and 4.7-inch guns on the same ship, that's a step too far even for the Royal Navy. The 5.25 is, of course, supposed to be a dual-purpose weapon, so the 4.7s are irrelevant unless you've decided you need even more anti-aircraft firepower, but there are much better choices for that, which, you know, we will discuss in a second. But going over the 5.25s, I know it's in keeping with the general aesthetic of the ship, but you have possibly made an even worse 5.25 turret than the cylindrical types found on the King George V's. And those were pretty bad, again, because of cramped conditions. These are mostly of a cylindrical base, but they're now also very domed. So there's practically no room inside for the crew to manoeuvre, unless, of course, again, you've expanded these to the size of small houses, in which case you've added a bunch of weight. And again, much like the main turrets, you've got this weird kind of conformal superstructure type thing, which, again, any amount of damage is going to jam up two-thirds of your little heavy anti-aircraft nest. And because of its presence, and the way you've clustered everything here as well, you've got a situation whereby you have six guns in three relatively heavy turrets, supposedly for secondary and anti-aircraft work, and while the top one has a very nice arc of fire, the fore and aft guns each probably can't actually traverse much beyond broadside. So you can only bring two-thirds of your 5.25-inch guns to bear on any given aerial target, which isn't really the best move. And then, as I said, the 4.7s are kind of superfluous. What exactly do they offer? What would be a better way of doing this? Well, for one thing, just scrap the 4.7s entirely and go with 5.25s. And in fact, actually also that little sort of funnel-shaped twin pom-pom as well. Get rid of that. Instead, take a leaf out of the US Navy's book if you really, really want absolutely tons of guns, and have them in offset layers with a step back. So you'd have your two 5.25-inch turrets, although hopefully with a better turret layout, roughly where they are in this case, and then replace those two 4.7-inch turrets with 5.25s and replace the funnel-shaped pom-pom mount with another 5.25. That means you've eliminated the superfluous 4.7 and thus simplified your ammunition supply, and all of the gun turrets have actually far better arcs of fire. Now, of course, this will have a bit of a stability issue because you have three guns high and two low, but you could just swap those positions around and have three low and two high if stability was a major problem. Or better yet, if you have stability and weight issues, or to be honest, if your only other choice is the cylindrical King George V turret, just use the 4.5-inch installations as found on the Renown, the Queen Elizabeth, and Valiant, because then you'll get an arguably far better dual-purpose weapon for a lighter installation and much, much more practical handling inside the turrets. The exact position of the aircraft installation, just here on the left, I mean, it's not awful. It's in keeping with the positioning on British cruisers and battleships of the time and a midships system with a launch rail. They have actually included a crane this time, so you can get the aircraft back. But I'm not so sure about having the boat deck above it. That's just asking to foul your aircraft launch facility the minute a shell or bomb goes off in the vicinity. And of course, you have this random twin turret mounted in what in British battleship terminology would be Q position between the superstructure elements. I'm not sure what this is supposed to do, because much like the 5.25 installations, this thing probably can't traverse much, if at all, past broadside, if it can turn at all, as again, assuming artistic merit at that point. But yeah, it's not really going to be able to offer all that much in the forward arc. It's going to have a fire arc that's actually incredibly limited, in part by the aft anti-aircraft cluster, which you can see just to the left there, at which point this actually might have a narrower fire arc than the N-echelon turrets you find on things like the Invincible-class battlecruisers. And it's mounted quite high. It's not quite as high as the super-firing twin up front, but it is on the same level as the super-firing triples at either end, so that's adding even more weight and stability issues. If you were going to have this at all, I would eliminate the boat deck and drop this thing down one to save you some weight issues at the very minimum. But to be perfectly honest, for all the impact this is going to have on your design, I don't think a twin turret is worth it at all. If we're following my previous idea of replacing the triples with quads, then we already have 16 guns just in quadruple turrets. We've eliminated the super firing twin turret. And at that point, to be honest, 16 guns, for all the added complications that this amidships twin is going to bring us, I really don't think we need it. we can just scrap it completely. It's also going to save a huge amount of magazine space further down. If you're obsessed with having the 18 guns, then I would say actually reinstating the forward twin is probably a better bet than keeping this one. Yes, it's going to have slightly more stability impacts, but the overall impact on the amidships of having this amidships turret is just bad. And if you really, 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 really want to go for broke when it comes to guns, then by eliminating this turret here, you could potentially even move the superstructure slightly further aft. And if you eliminate the twin up front, you could potentially even go for a Nelson-style layout with another quad lower down, as a very, very specifically Nelson layout. And that would actually give you 20 guns with less stability and less internal arrangement issues than this 18-gun layout. And it would be simpler to produce, believe it or not. And then we get to the stern, and, well, we've already talked about the main battery issues. Telescopic mast, take it or leave it. That's a bit more complication than's probably needed, but you can get away with it fine. The exhaust outlet at the stern, we're going to talk about that exhaust system in a minute. You'll notice we have six screws, because there's three on this side and presumably three on the other side. No. It didn't work on the Popovs, those slightly odd circular ships. It's not going to work here. The amount of additional weight and redundancy of equipment that you're going to have with six screws, you're not going to get much, if any, speed benefit, and you're going to massively overcomplicate the machinery spaces. Just go back to four screws and, you know, distribute the power slightly differently. I mean, heck, it might even save you on a couple of turbines, which will save additional weight. This is a very, very bad idea, these six screw installations. And again, with the anti-aircraft battery, we've already mentioned a potential way around that issue. Although the fact that this thing is rocking so many gun turrets, both as the secondary and main guns, yeah, 70,000 tons, I would say, is possibly slightly underselling how big and heavy and long this thing is probably going to be. So we've looked at the ship generally. Now let's go and look at the cross sections, starting with the cross section that deals with its supposed torpedo defense system, but also interestingly talks a little bit about the armor and the exhausts. So you'll notice that we have two methods of attack shown here. We have a plunging shell, presumably from some kind of mortar at the angle that it's coming in, and we have these torpedoes, or a torpedo, but shown going in multiple different directions. Now, you'll see the armor belt there, 5-inch, 7-inch, 12-inch. Weirdly enough, we've replicated the belt armor of HMS Hood. And actually, if you look at the deck armor, with it canting up and over the exhaust vent, we have actually literally replicated the armor layer of HMS Hood. Plus, we've got a 2-inch forecastle deck right up top. This is definitely not a brilliant idea. It means we've got a relatively shallow 12-inch belt. We're spending an awful lot of weight up top for this 5-inch and then 7-inch strake, which only makes sense under a distributed armor scheme, which is very much not the latest and greatest in 1940, except at very steep angles of the ship coming in towards its attacker. It's not really going to do anything to incoming enemy shells. So on that note, realistically, what you should be doing is reducing that 5-inch and 7-inch section to, you know, maybe 1-inch anti-splinter plating, and using all that saved weight to increase both the thickness and the height of the main belt, and also adjusting the main armored deck so it's actually flat level on top of the main armored belt, basically your standard World War II battleship all or nothing scheme. That, however, is the least of our concerns, because the designer of this ship clearly does not know how torpedoes work. He's envisaging the torpedoes, A, coming in at exactly the right level to impact on the curved section of the hull where the exhaust vent is, which you'll notice is just below the waterline. More on that later. But he's then thinking the torpedo is going to deflect. No. This is going to be outer hull shell plating. That torpedo is going to slam into it. That torpedo is going to detonate. It's not going to deflect in any meaningful way. At which point, thanks to this exhaust vent system, you're going to have an explosion that, as you can see, will go straight underneath the armor belt, so the armor belt will offer no resistance to it. But thanks to the trunking for the boilers coming out, is also got a fairly decent chance of bypassing the torpedo defense system, which is only continuous below the exhaust vent. And so this explosion is just going to go straight through any and all protection of the ship, blast through what is presumably just trunking plating on the inside of the downwards portion of the trunk, through this slightly weird hollow space, and straight into the machinery spaces, in the case of this amidships hit, or the magazines, if you're fore and aft, or possibly directly amidships, if you're still retaining that silly amidships twin turret. So you've paid the money and the displacement penalties for your inclined armor belt system and what otherwise is actually a not brilliant but not terrible torpedo defense system layout, and just put a socking great hole in the middle of it, right at where you expect the torpedoes to come. You basically created a ship that could potentially be one-shotted by a single torpedo with ambitions. This is absolutely, absolutely awful. And there's another thing. Speaking of shells coming at an angle, but at a slightly more realistic angle, you'll notice the bulge for this exhaust vent means that a good chunk of hull plating starts to curve outward from the inward curvature of the rest of the hull, forward of or outboard of the main armor belt. But if you look where that waterline is, that means that actually fire from more realistic guns at maybe 20,000-25,000 yards could potentially drop in above the water, slam into the hull plating, and then carry on down into the exhaust vent through the gap underneath the main armor belt, and then straight into the machinery spaces or the magazines. So not only have you created a pathway for a torpedo explosion to get straight into your vitals, you've actually created a fairly glaring waterline weak spot where mid to long distance shell fire could just pop your ship like a very expensive balloon. And all of this for an exhaust system that is actually, flooding and ship destruction issues aside, just generally a catastrophically bad idea. This kind of trunked exhaust system, as a general principle, was tried by various navies, including the British and the Japanese, on various ships, Argus, Furious, Akagi and Kaga in the earliest configurations. And even when it's mounted much higher, above the waterline, it just doesn't work very well. It uses a huge amount of space. It tends to heat up the internal areas of the hull quite a bit, and it adds a huge amount of weight. Now, here, not only will you be cooking your crew nice and evenly, because, well, this thing runs all the way down the side right to the end, so you know, lots of heat being vented back into your ship, you've got the weaknesses that we've just discussed, you've got a huge amount of additional weight involved, but also all this hot exhaust not only doesn't have much of a draft for your boilers, but it's running right adjacent to the comparatively very cold seawater, which means that as the exhaust runs along the length of your ship, it's going to be very rapidly bleeding heat into the seawater. That's going to make the exhaust colder and less energetic. And of course, as it gets colder, which means it's also going to get denser, which means that rather than acting as an exhaust, it's actually going to cause the much hotter exhaust fumes, gases, and smoke behind it to back up, acting as a kind of plug, obviously not a complete one, but nearly a complete one. And that's going to either mean that your boilers can only run at a fraction of their realistic output power, or when you do try and ramp them up to full, they're just going to exhaust into your boiler rooms, which is not a good thing in the slightest. Now, this overall armor layout, as I said, could be salvaged, but only with very extensive changes. Like I said, convert it to an all-or-nothing flat armored deck, take off the 5 and 7-inch plating, replace it with 1-inch, expand the 12-inch down through, you know, put in a conventional funnel system, remove this silly exhaust vent, put the belt armor down, bring the torpedo defense system up, eliminate this silly outboard nonsense, and then you'd have something that, well, actually at that point would resemble a slightly thickened up Iowa belt system. But yeah, this idea, not going to work. And so we find ourselves moving over to the last cross section, the one at the top right here, and we'll very quickly go through a few of the labeled items that potentially bring up even more concern. So number one, Forter Arf bulkhead. For those of you who might find the number one difficult to find, indeed it took me a while to spot, it's right in the middle. It's basically talking about a longitudinal bulkhead. This is not the world's most brilliant idea. The idea of, if we get a hole in one side, we don't want it to flood through all the way to the other side if there's a big chamber like a machinery space, is good in principle. The problem, as they found with things like Ark Royal, was that if you just divide your big chambers up by putting this amidships longitudinal bulkhead on the center line, well, you end up with still quite a lot of flooding, except now it's more on one side and you capsize. Now, in this case, that might not be the world's most terrible idea, because it has said that they're putting the engine, each engine and boiler room, in a separate watertight compartment, thus creating a unit system, thus reducing the overall volume. So given the egregious nature of some of the other issues with the ship, I'm going to let that one slide as a, you know, you could take it or leave it, but it could be a not quite so terrible decision. And just in case you're wondering, this cross section is taken basically just aft of the amidships twin turret, just forward of the aircraft launch facilities, and we're looking forward. So then we have fuel valve, boiler, combustion chamber, yeah, whatever. Gas turbine and blower. Well, if you want to have a gas turbine in there, I guess you can. 4, 5, and 6, port propeller shafts. We've already said what we need to say about, you know, the idea of having 6 propellers. It's not a good idea. Turbine set, fine. Oil fuel tanks. So here you can see the lower part of the fuel tanks actually form part of the torpedo defense system, which isn't a bad shout, all things considered. It means that from the looks of things, you've got a liquid-void-liquid system going, which is a functional, if basic, torpedo defense system, the big, you know, void above it caused by the exhaust system notwithstanding. But I do have a couple of concerns. Firstly, these triangular oil tanks are not going to hold a huge amount of fuel compared to rectangular cross-section tanks. And secondly, it seems like we've got a very, very tall stack of oil tanks and just a very thin bulkhead going into the engine room. And with that curvature of the hull, meaning the outer liquid layer is quite thin as well, I can't see this system standing up to a particularly heavy torpedo impact, at which point you're going to get a bunch of fuel projected straight into the machinery spaces, which isn't a good thing if for the life expectancy of the engineers. I mean, the whole thing is probably fairly unstable anyway. When you look at the whole thing being an upside down trapezoid, the lower hull really does need a little bit more fleshing out towards the lower end of it. So placement not terrible, but the overall layout and design of this part of the ship is pretty bad. Then we've got a cable tunnel labeled number 9. Well, at least it's below the armor deck. It is going to get immediately taken out by any torpedo strike to the exhaust system, though, but there you go. Control platform, I'm presuming that's it's either going to be a backup control set place, or it's their terminology for a fire control computer setup. Either way, it's positioned under the armor. Again, not awful. The exhaust uptakes, i.e. the funnel trunking, and then watertight dampeners allowing control of gases to one side or the other. Well, that's very much closing the door after the horse is bolted. This entire exhaust system is, as we've covered, a completely terrible idea. And there's the exhaust outlets, again, showing the massive hole in the protection system that they're causing. Then, apparently, this ship has people who are, you know, very, very happy with it, because label 14, we have fans being stored just above the boiling hot trunking for some bizarre reason. Yes, of course, they are supposed to be actual, you know, air moving fans. I'm not entirely sure what they're supposed to do. They're in, again, this weird trapezoid chamber that doesn't seem to have much other function. And about the only thing I can think of is that maybe they're moving the hot air that's going to inevitably be percolating up through the ship to some kind of vent system further along. But it's just a bit of a pointless waste of space, really. Petty officer's mess, engineering workshops. Yeah, these are the kind of things you'd find at that kind of level. 17, ammunition trunk. Now, this does cause me concern because this is supposed to be a cross-section, so where the heck is this going? You know, this is a main battery turret. You can't possibly be ending the ammunition trunk, well, at least a deck above the waterline. So presumably this is going deeper down, but to where? There's no indication below that there is space in the machinery chambers for a magazine. And even if there was, well, putting a magazine in the middle of all of these boilers is not a good idea if you want to maintain a steady level of temperature control. And even if you can, well, you stuck a magazine in the middle of the machinery chambers, and given the direct access to this part of the ship for torpedoes and potentially even shells given by the silly exhaust system, you've basically set a please shoot here to make entire ship explode section. And if the magazine isn't down there, well, where is it? Because it's not on the upper deck where the engineer's workshop is. You know, is it hiding between the exhaust gas trunking? I don't know. Then you have the gun turret working chamber and the Seaman's mess. They're all fine. But yeah, this is another reason why we should definitely eliminate this twin turret, because it appears to either not have an ammunition supply or have an ammunition supply that is positioned in such a way as it's almost designed to destroy the ship the minute she gets in combat. And here's roughly what the thing would have looked like, thanks to Tsolly, if it had actually been built. And actually, when I was looking at this picture, which, you know, obviously translates it into a side-on and top-down view, I noticed something else that is a bit concerning, which is that there is very, very little scope for light and medium anti-aircraft guns. Yes, you've got an octuple or quad pom-pom, I think it's an octuple, forward of the bridge, and a quad aft of the bridge up top, and then either another quad or octuple at the aft end of the superstructure. And then you've got the little twins scattered on little outriggers. But that's not a huge number of emplacements. And then when you look at the deck, which is where you'd expect most of these, you know, 20 and 40 mil guns to be stuck, either during the time period the ship's actually being designed or immediately thereafter, there just isn't really anywhere for them to go. You know, you could in theory put some at the extreme bow and extreme stern like the US did there, but other than that, you can't put them adjacent to the main turrets because the blast of the turrets will send the crews scuttling for cover and probably damage the guns themselves. And amidships, well, you've got another main gun battery, and because of these clusters of 5.25 and 4.7-inch guns, basically the whole of the deck is just a huge blast zone. So you basically just have to rely on those few pom-pom installations and your heavy AA, which isn't a good thing by a long way. So if we're, you know, putting aside torpedo defense system and armor changes, which we've discussed already, if we were going to reorganize the armament layout to, well, allow for our light and medium AA guns and just be more sensible generally, as I've mentioned earlier, I would eliminate both twin turrets, upgrade the triples to quadruples, and be, well, quote unquote, happy with only 16 14-inch guns. Or potentially, given that this is 1940 and the Royal Navy's planning on building the Lions, perhaps go with triple 16s and have 12 16-inch guns instead, either of which would be a vaguely respectable armament for a ship of this scale. And that actually allows you to get a much better anti-aircraft layout going. Now, as I said, I'd eliminate the 4.7s and the 5.25s and just use the 4.5-inch pancake-style turrets. And now that you don't have to worry about the blast radius of your amidships turret, because we've gotten rid of that, I think adopting a US-style turret layout, so lower guns and then step back to upper guns, I think you could quite easily get four twin 4.5s running forward from just forward of the aircraft launching and handling facilities to roughly where the armament as proposed terminates here. And then have three more sets of twin 4.5s stepped back, obviously in between them. That gives you a total of 14 4.5-inch guns on either side. So that's four guns more than the average US fast battleship, which, you know, given that this thing's supposed to be around 70,000 tons, is fair enough. That's an excellent dual-purpose armament, and it leaves the entire area aft, where previously there was another cluster of these 5.25s, completely free. So you can have a stepped arrangement of 20mm Oerlikons and then 40mm Bofors and or pom-poms, completely free of potential interference by gunfire, for the most part, running on either side of the aft superstructure. So that's a good thing. Obviously, maybe stick some Bofors on top of the turrets as well. And because we've eliminated the twin super firing turret up forward, that also means that forward of our heavy AA gun nest, so from roughly halfway along the bridge tower and then forward up to where we'd have our super firing quad 14 inch turret or triple 16, either way, and obviously not in these encapsulated housings, all along that forward section of deck, basically up to the secondary breakwater, you could have another battery of 40mm, 20mm, etc. So you could have the world's heaviest battleship and anti-aircraft battery in terms of heavy dual-purpose guns, and two massive, mostly uninterfered with clusters of light to medium anti-aircraft guns. I mean, obviously, spruce the bow up a little bit as well, get rid of that silly whaleback design. And, well, I think that's the best way you could salvage this. I mean, yes, you're pretty much changing almost everything there is about it, apart from maybe the overall aesthetic of the superstructure. But that is really as far as you'd have to go to make this a true battleship of the future. Anyway, let me know what you think in the comments below. What would you change? Is there anything you like about the design other than what I've mentioned already? And, well, thanks for listening.